Welcome to the Sino AI Insights. I'm Xiao Qian. From Beijing to the world, Sino AI Insight brings you informed perspectives on artificial intelligence, policy, and global governance from China and beyond. In the episodes ahead, we will speak with emerging scholars and leading experts to unpack how AI is shaping international order, economic transformation, and security debates.
When people talk about AI computation today, they often focus on chips, models, or applications. But behind every frontier AI models lies a much layer infrastructure ecosystem. Data centers, electricity, cloud systems, subsea cables, semiconductors, and energy networks. AI computation is now becoming not only a technological computation, but also a competition over infrastructure, energy capacity, and digital sovereignty. Today, we are joined by Professor George Chen, who recently delivered a lecture at CISS Tsinghua University on AI infrastructure and the evolving China-US technology competition landscape. And last week, he was in the room when NVIDIA Jason Huang dialed in to speak to the audience at the JP Morgan China Summit, when Jason laid out his vision for the era of AI factories and agentic AI. Professor Chen is a distinguished visiting professor at Schwarzman College, Tsinghua University, senior fellow at the Center of Civil Society and the Governance of the University of Hong Kong. He previously served as Meta's first managing director of public policy for Greater China. He's now also a partner and chair of digital practice at the Asia Group. We will discuss why energy is becoming the hidden foundation of AI power, how data centers are reshaping geopolitics, and whether AI competition will lead to fragmentation or new forms of cooperation. So, Professor Chen, welcome to Sino AI Insight. One of the most interesting points in your lecture was that AI competition is ultimately rooted in infrastructure competition. So why do you think infrastructure has become so central in the AI era?
First of all, Professor Xiao, thanks for having me. It's always good to be back to CISS. I hope the students and audience enjoyed my last lecture. I wanted to make a very simple but very important point, which was inspired by some industry people when they looked at AI. The saying in the industry, in Chinese, we call it 电力及算力. That's the first part. In English, it means electricity and or power supply equals to compute. The second part, I just threw my conclusion first. The second part is 万力及国力. So how powerful the computer, how advanced the computer a country can have in different models and leading AI companies, it means a lot to the strength of the nation in the era of the AI. Based on that conclusion, so I did some research, and I found out it was fascinating. You know, even you, most of the time we saw like ChatGPT, Sam Altman, Mark Zuckerberg, Llama, those are like the fancy things on the surface, right? You know, but sometimes people don't, I think the efforts behind those AI apps and developments, we talk about the digital infrastructure, were kind of like underappreciated. But without the infrastructure, I made a comparison, you know, of AI as a very beautiful Ferrari. If you don't have the superhighway, which is the infrastructure, the digital infrastructure, then the Ferrari cannot go anywhere. So that's the importance of data center for AI. But what keeps data center on, that's electricity. That's the very, you know, simple version. And I just threw the conclusion first.
So as you mentioned clearly, that electricity itself seems to be becoming a strategic resource right now. So can we say that we are now entering an era where energy capacity defines AI capacity?
Totally. Let's use Singapore as an example. Singapore is already an advanced economy. I don't think anyone will be worried about the power supply in Singapore. Meta actually launched its first data center in Asia Pacific in Singapore. That was back to 2017-2018. The first year after the data center in Singapore was launched, I think the Singaporean government was also shocked. Together, you know, alongside with Meta, Microsoft, that was like the boom era, you know, of data centers in Singapore. All the data center operations account for around like 15% of the entire country's electricity output usage. And that was just like 5, 6, 7 years ago, right? And it seems like no one can stop the boom of AI. The more AI capacity we need, the more data center capacity we need. And that will be translating to like how much power supply we need. So even countries like Singapore are worried about, you know, how to make power supply sustainable for data center expansions. I mean, not to mention Singapore is not going to like use coal energy to generate electricity, right? You know, the data centers all require renewable energies. So that is a big challenge for countries like Singapore and even India, who's also very ambitious in AI developments. And there's also a lot of investments in data center in India. So all the countries in APAC, I'm sure, you know, this is the same topic, you know, in Europe, are concerned or trying to explore what the best renewable energy solution could be to support the rapid developments of data centers. You know, because if you think about renewable energy data center development, it's not like you have money and you can get something tomorrow. So if you think about like a wind, hydro, even solar, it does take some years to build the capacity. And data center investments, you know, when we talk about data center, we talk about like a 10 years, 20 years plan. It's not like you go to buy an apartment and then you can just live in and that's it.
Right, right. So just now you mentioned about countries like Singapore and Malaysia. And also I know that even Mongolia, as you mentioned in your lecture, that even Mongolia are positioning themselves in this global center data center economy.
Correct.
Could you elaborate more here that what makes some countries attractive for this AI infrastructure investment?
Right. So when I was at Meta, I'm pretty sure other tech companies also have something similar. Every tech company has a team, something like the data center site selection task force, which usually comprise of engineers and other type of experts. So I'm not an engineer. I come more from a public policy background. So there are like 7-8 factors to decide, you know, where we will put the data center in. From a technical perspective, adequate power supply is the number one consideration. If a country is short of power supplies, then don't talk about anything else, right? And then the second thing is whether the country has 100% or, you know, close to 100% renewable energy, because this is also almost a mandatory requirement for all the big tech companies when they consider data center investments. Apart from that, there's also a lot of non-technical factors to consider. For example, the bureaucracy or the efficiency of the government, right? There are some countries who are known for corruption, bribery and corruption. This is not good news, especially for American companies when they look at data center investments, because one data center could be easily like $500 million to $1 billion or even more investments, right? And you talk about like 20 years experience, how much money, you know, will be really taken to investments rather than taken to bribery, not to mention there's also very strict CPA compliance in the US, especially for American companies. We also look at the geopolitical reasons, right? If the country is stuck in a situation where, for example, US-China competitions, I can share you an example. We talk about data center, but in my lecture, I also talk about the importance of cables, right? So if you think about data center is on the land, right? And how can we get the whole world connected? That's cables. One of the first projects when I was at Meta, you know, we worked on what is a cable called the PLCN, Pacific Light Cable Network, which was supposed to, back to 2016, which was supposed to connect starting from Hong Kong, and then it was supposed to land in LAX, Los Angeles. But given the US-China tensions, you know, eventually the FCC, it was not Meta's problem, it was not like Chinese government didn't want to do it, but it was the US government, the FCC's decision to not to allow any cables to start from, you know, Chinese to land on US soil. So the cable has to let, we call the Hong Kong part, sleep, so switch to other places. So that's a classic example of geopolitics. And you mentioned Mongolia. That's also a very interesting example, right? I've been to Mongolia many times, and the government is very ambitious. They also look at the AI era as an opportunity. But I told them, yes, Mongolia, if we tick the box, right, there was like 7-8 factors. Of course, land is also another factor, right, in this space. Mongolia has enough land, very cheap cost. Temperature, you know, cooling is also a very important factor. Fantastic, because if you go to Mongolia, like after November, it's like a minus 20, 30 degree. Perfect weather, you know, for data center. However, Mongolia is quite left behind in renewable energy developments, right? And then officials ask me like, so how can we attract foreign investors for data centers? And I said, you need to invest in renewable energy first. And they were a little bit hesitated. It's like, oh, you know, then we need a lot of money. So it become a chicken or egg question. You know, do you want to invest in your energy first? Otherwise, how can you attract the data center investments?
Well, there are really a lot of factors to be considered when making investment decisions. Just now you mentioned about geopolitics. I also wanted to ask you, because as digital infrastructure becomes increasingly strategic and nationalized, and people call the weaponization of computer supply chains.
Right.
So do you think, are we heading toward a fragmented world where major powers each build their own AI ecosystem? Or can shared economic and security interests still drive some form of international cooperation?
I am worried the trend in terms of AI, what does AI development mean to the whole world, right? We already have camps. The world is quite divided, you know, global south, global north, and we have G20 in US allies, this and that. I hate to say that, but on the sort of the application part, we already have US AI models, ChatGPT, cloud, and they are closed systems. And China is a big advocate for open source models like DeepSeek, right? This is already a clear example to keep the AI development divided. Mm-hmm. On the infrastructure part, the reality is only several big countries have enough money in terms of capital to build data center infrastructure, and not to mention like cables and other developments. So there is also a growing worries, you know, the so-called digital colonialism. I think Jensen Huang also mentioned in one of his recent presentations, you know, we're kind of like moving from the social media era to the AI era. But in the social media era, there were already a lot of concerns about digital colonialism, right? Like more than 5 or 6 out of 10 most popular social media apps are US apps, right? What does that mean in terms of, you know, cultural and political nuances, right? You know, at the end of the day, it's also about ideology. And then when it comes to AI era, how many leading cloud operators in the world, you know, are America versus China, right? So other countries, the middle power, look at the situation. They will naturally think about, like, you know, how can I have a reliable solution, right? A platform. That's how geopolitical factors also weigh in. Okay, so if I'm the ally of US today, and then tomorrow, if I don't follow US foreign policy, let's say I disagree on the Iran situation or the Ukraine situation, will the US government, you know, pressure or simply just put the country in the on the sanction list? And then what does that mean? You know, can I still use the American cloud service or not, right? So China is already in such a dilemma, right? There's a lot of discussions, you know, on China should, you know, buy more H200 from NVIDIA, right? But from the Chinese buyer perspective, yeah, President Trump just visited, you know, Beijing. He was quite nice, very respectful when he was in China. But who knows, right? You know, US changing president. What about next president? You know, suddenly say, okay, sorry, you cannot get H200 anymore, or you cannot get any upgrade for H200. And then what about the H200 I already bought? So that, especially for AI developments, you talk about very long-term planning rather than I just buy a phone. Okay, I can use it tomorrow, you know, today, and then tomorrow I change a new phone. It's not easy, you know, once you sort of hooked up on a certain type of technology.
Right, interesting. You mentioned the digital colonialism, which is a very interesting point here, because now we also hear people talking about digital sovereignty.
Right.
And also in your lecture, you mentioned, you described the digital sovereignty as involving infrastructure ownership, mm-hmm. regulatory rules, and the control over data companies.
Data, yeah.
So could you please elaborate more on that? And also the question is, why are governments increasingly treating data center and cloud infrastructure as strategic assets?
Right, right. So the data centers are widely considered as so-called critical infrastructure by many countries. The reason is simple. If you think in the old economy, we talk about infrastructure like airports, railways, power plants, right? Those are the critical infrastructure for sure, right? If any conflicts or war happen, you know, those are the targets. Like if you think about during World War II, right? Those things will be first seized the control, you know, by your enemies, or if they just want to bomb it to disrupt the economy. And in today's economy, data center is equally important as old-fashioned infrastructures like electricity plants. The electricity plants become more important as we just discussed how important it, you know, it is to support AI developments. But once you occupy a data center, once you disrupt the data center, it will affect a lot of things. All the EVs running in the street, they are powered by AI. And where AI works, the AI operates in data centers, right? So it's just like we human beings, we go to work, we have an office, we go back home, we have an apartment. The data centers are like the apartment and offices for AI, where AI works and lives. Mm-hmm. So I'm not saying we're going to have a war tomorrow, but you can totally imagine those are the strategic targets, right, as critical infrastructure. This is also why a lot of the governments around the world, they begin to define critical infrastructure. They begin to include digital infrastructure as critical infrastructure. And there was a lot of regulations coming out in Europe and in Asia. Even in, you know, in a small place like Hong Kong, we just passed the new critical infrastructure law to require the data center operators to comply with the government to enforce the law, which means, you know, if there's national security related investigations, and the operator has the duty, responsibility, you know, to cooperate with investigations. US has similar requirements.
Mm-hmm.
So I think given the importance of AI and data science, all the countries are naturally more concerned about it. There's always a what if question, you know, from a national security perspective. So that is why the data centers are treated more as a strategic critical infrastructure. On the digital sovereignty part, there are three models, basically, that a lot of countries are looking at. You know, one, as I said, you know, US and China, capital-wise, the big countries have enough capital to invest. So in China, we have Alibaba, Tencent, ByteDance. They build up their own data centers, right? The middle power, they don't have enough money. They don't have like leading companies like, you know, Huawei or Alibaba or you know, Meta or Google. So they very much rely on either Chinese or Western data center cloud services, right? However, sometimes they also want the service operators to comply with local regulations. Or sometimes they can co-invest certain objects. Worst of worst are those very poor developing countries to the end of the list, including some countries in Africa. What are they going to do, right? Their infrastructure is already very bad. You know, we talk about the telecoms era, right? Some of the countries are still remaining 4G rather than to get on 5G. For them to get on to the AI era, they need to first move on from the basic telecoms infrastructure, you know, now, and then to talk about data centers. So for them, they were 100% rely on other countries to support them. And then the concern about digital colonialism will be even, you know, bigger, right?
Exactly.
If imagine if you put your entire civil service on a cloud that is owned by a foreign company.
True.
And the foreign company needs to comply first with their home country laws rather than to respect the laws in the country where this private services, there will be a lot of conflicts between the legal systems and other issues.
Exactly. Well, same as if the digital divide will get bigger and bigger,
right,
if it develops this direction. So we talk about, just now you mentioned the three types of countries. Let's look at two regions that are trying to carve out their own paths in digital sovereignty. For example, the Gulf states, they have enormous oil wealth and energy resources,
mm-hmm.
And were planning to become the global AI hubs. But the recent Iran war seems to have disrupted these plans. So what happened and what does this tell us about the geopolitical risks of building AI infrastructure? Do you have any?
Right. Yeah, I mentioned that, you know, usually people have like 7-8 factors when they decide, you know,
yes,
the data center.
Yes.
We talk about the importance of power supply, clean energy, cooling, which is very about the nature, like temperature in the land, geopolitics. Physical security is also important, transparency of the government. And there's another thing is, you know, the regional security. No one will put the money in a war zone, right? Unfortunately, in Chinese, we say the Gulf region, this time, Chinese words are like, 躺着中枪. You know, the whole Iran war, it was really out of blue, right? They are just the neighbors. And what did they do, right? They tried to be friendly with everyone. And before the Iran war, you are right, you know, Professor Xiao, and I think Gulf was quite ambitious. They have almost everything other countries want. They have money, they have land, and they can, because they have a lot of money, they basically try to think about how to make the money from oil and then turn the money they make from the oil business into some strategic investments. A data center will be perfect as a category of investment for them to. And then they also want to, like countries like, you know, UAE, Qatar, they really want to turn Gulf as the perfect AI hub, right? Like between West and East. For example, Dubai and Doha are already the aviation hubs, right? So you can see Gulf's ambition is to create basically copy the success of aviation hub for Doha and Dubai. Into the AI era, how they can make some cities into the AI. The plan almost is perfect. And Gulf is also, you know, pretty friendly, you know, with the US. Trump was there last year, promised to ship a large amount of NVIDIA chips, right? And then suddenly the Iran war happened. And then we all saw the news that at least two or three data centers in the region operated by AWS and Microsoft got hit. I think this was the first time American tech assets were under attack on foreign soil, right? What does that mean to American tech cloud operators, right? And how can both quickly regain confidence from the users? There's a lot of questions. The worst thing is, yes, the Gulf countries, you know, they have money. They can repair and recover the 2 or 3 data centers under attack very quickly. However, as I said, the data center investments are a very long investment. We talk about 10 years, 20 years. No one has a crystal ball or guarantee can, you know, even Trump will sign a peace deal with Iran tomorrow, but who can be sure, like, the situation will not repeat in 5 years later, right? Once people see the image, like the videos, you know, the data center got hit by the drones, the perception about the region just simply changed. And physical security, regional security are also the two key factors often cited, you know, by tech companies when they consider, you know, data center investments.
True, yes. That's a very, very good analysis. But let's zoom also into the region you know better than most, Asia-Pacific. It is the largest internet user base for almost every major tech company out there. And also these days, Singapore, Malaysia, Indonesia, and even Vietnam are competing to attract data centers, and also US and China. US and Chinese companies are also trying to compete for the markets there.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you think, do they have their unique advantages and challenges? And also, how are they navigating the China-US tech competition for those countries?
Right. In the Southeast Asia region, I will say Malaysia is really a surprise, you know, for many people in the industry. Over the 2 to 3 years, you know, they've attracted a significant amount of investments from almost every big names we know, and from both US and China. And Huawei, I think, it just set up a very new and big headquarters in the center of KL in Malaysia. That's a very good vote of confidence from China in Malaysia's economic look. You also got Microsoft, Google, AWS investing in Malaysia. Malaysia's, the rise of Malaysia was partly the result, as I mentioned, you know, Singapore got data centers first, and then they were concerned about how big, you know, the percentage in terms of the output taken by the data centers. So the Singapore government sort of have a freeze on new data center investments for some years, and then Malaysia took out the opportunity, and now Singapore is concerned again. So the two countries and neighboring countries, they also have some friendly competitions from time to time. I mean, not to mention investments in AI are always very expensive, right? So Jensen Huang is not going to cut a price for his GPUs. The data centers, as I said, one data center is $500 million to $1 billion, even more investments. So when the companies look at where to put the center, they also look at, okay, Malaysia has cheaper land, and they have more land than Singapore, relatively smaller country, right? So those five factors also be considered in, especially when the GPU price, you know, keep rising, the HBM price keep rising. So if you are the CFO of Meta, you will look at, like, where can I save some money apart from layoff? And then we will look at land and whether the country have some preferable policies to attract investments. So Malaysia is a highlight. Vietnam is also very trying, but I heard from a lot of, you know, industry people, some of the disadvantages for Vietnam is still the shortage of talents. It's okay, you can quickly move a plant to Vietnam or Bangladesh for labor intensive industry. You know, for example, actually nowadays you hardly can find a t-shirt made in China, right? In the stores. Like you talk about Nike, Uniqlo. I last time I checked, I can't find any t-shirt shows made in China. All like made in Vietnam, Bangladesh. It tells something, right? The labor cost but for data centers and for AI technology developments, and also if you think about Apple, also part of the supply chain products, they look for skilled workers. When it comes to skilled workers, it's not like you can have, you know, a turn of skilled workers like just tomorrow. It takes a lot of training. I think Tim Cook said this when he was in China at a conference. I heard that in person. He told people the reason why, you know, Apple cannot leave China, Apple still have the majority of supply chain in China, is not simply because Chinese laborers are cheap. Chinese laborers are not the cheapest compared with other countries nowadays, right? Not like 20 years ago. The core reason is China has a lot more skilled workers, well-trained, you know, better trained than other countries. So for the time being, at least for the foreseeable futures, though this is a big factor for those countries to consider investments, right? Otherwise, if you build a data center, you need engineers, you need to test, to operate, to maintain. You can't avoid any risk if things go wrong, right? It's just like you make 100 iPhones. If 20 out of 100 iPhones cannot pass the quality approval, it means a loss, right? So, you know, on surface, it looks like, okay, this country's labor is cheaper than China, you know, but overall cost in terms of training and other things. So Apple is smart, you know, this is why, you know, Apple still keeps, you know, the majority supply chain in China. But of course, you know, diversity of supply chain is also a trend, you know, mostly for security reasons, right? You know, if you think about COVID, earthquake, that's totally fine. But I just don't think, you know, from supply chain perspective, like any company can just like say 100%, you know, do hardware without anything to do with China.
Another country which is also very interesting in this landscape is India, because we know India is, the government is very ambitious.
They correct.
Host the last AI Impact Summit. And also we see a lot of US companies invest a lot in India. So what this kind of role that India is going to play in this future AI landscape?
Right. I think you're absolutely right. I won't call myself India expert, but I think everybody know, you know, India is very ambitious in the era of AI. I think Prime Minister Modi even jokingly said in the era of AI, because it's AI, it makes America India. So you can see Modi's ambition to put India on the world map. It's okay. I actually encourage a competition, right? In history, you can see competition always generates more innovations, right? Because you don't want to be alone, just this one single player in the race. But I have to say, in terms of digital infrastructure, of course, India is still quite behind in comparison with China. Even in, we talk about digital infrastructure, but even in the old-fashioned infrastructures, airports and roads, that also matters, right? Because if you think about the data center build-up, you need to ship a lot of, you know, components to the country. And then the last mile of logistics also matter a lot, right? If you think about China, I remember my experience during COVID, Meta had a factory in Shanghai, but we need to source the components, you know, from nearby like Kunshan, Suzhou. But basically, alongside the superhighways, you can get all you want. So this is why the supply chain ecosystem in China, you know, remains pretty strong, you know, compared with India and other countries. But India has a lot of talents, right? You know, the Indian engineers, we need to give them some credit. They are one of the best in the world. I think Jensen also joked that like probably half of the engineers, AI engineers in the Silicon Valley are from India, or new migrants, right? So on the people front, no doubt about it. You know, I think India has a lot of, you know, advantages. And you are right. Somehow a lot of American tech companies, they always, when they consider opportunities for investment, they always compare India and China. And you can see this almost like a pattern. When the US-China relations go down, and then you will see the US tech investments in India are on the rise. And the US-China relations tend to be stable, and then we will also see investments in China tend to rise, you know, because especially for the multinational companies, they look at Asia, they look at big population, domestic market, fair play, access, this and that. So India, I don't want to call India an alternative, but I think my Indian friends won't be happy. But I think of both India and China, from American company perspective, provide the two options for investments.
So then talking about China, China has consistently sought to position AI as a public goods for developing countries.
Yeah, that's Premier Li Qiang's speech in Shanghai last year during the World AI Conference. Yeah.
Providing infrastructure, models, platforms, often at a lower cost compared to some other countries. So based on your observation, how do middle-income countries or nations in the global south view cooperation with China in the fields of AI infrastructure? Do they see this as a pragmatic choice?
Totally. I think Premier Li Qiang's speech at AIC last year in Shanghai were very well received, you know, by Global South, Belt and Road countries, and even, you know, some of the members of Shanghai Cooperation Organization. You know, you talk about those CIS countries, you know, Central Asian countries. They, you know, I was in Tashkent in Uzbekistan for an event. I can tell a lot of the officials and experts in Central Asia were very concerned, you know, about the whole AI developments. they were like, it was like obvious that was a question in the room, like, what about us? So we talk about OpenAI, we talk about DeepSeek, and then, you know, the natural question, you know, in the Central Asian countries are like, what about us? So China provided a very, you know, feasible solution. You know, first, you know, DeepSeek, you know, and other models from China are open sourced, right? Also know there's a term called the, you know, sovereignty AI, right? So the countries in Central Asia and Global South, they certainly welcome open source the model to develop their own sovereignty AI apps, right? And I can say, you know, because of DeepSeek, not just put China on the map, but also made the DeepSeek's rivals, you know, like Anthropic AI and OpenAI more nervous, right? You know, because suddenly China provided an alternative. If you don't want to, you know, choose the US technologies, at least, you know, there's a, actually, in terms of cost, it's also more affordable, right? In terms of efficiencies, so China becomes more popular among the Global South countries, right? And that also put China in competition with US, not just AI technology, but also in terms of almost like AI diplomacy, in terms of, you know, can influence the rest of the world, like which model other countries will use, right? At the end of the day, I worked in the social media industry for a long time, and I believe that AI and social media share one thing: scale matters, right? So whoever gets the first 1 billion users, that means a lot, right? And then that will become a pattern, and people will just get a user to it. And this is also why during the Spring Festival, the Chinese New Year, early this year, you see there's also a lot of competition between, you know, among Chinese AI players, right? Like Doubao and other apps. So it's interesting to see people race to get the bigger scale. And it's also important to export China AI to other countries.
Yes, you're right. The scale matters, and also seem as if the rhetoric of the AI race between China and the US is there. Do you think it's becoming more and more dangerous? Could it increase mistrust and reduce these opportunities for cooperation between the two countries?
Right, yeah. I know our dean at the Swarthmore College, Professor Shuela, hated the term US-China AI race. He will describe it as more like a marathon. It's a long game, right? I intend to agree. The media will play up the word, you know, race. After Trump's visit to China, you know, one of the hopeful signs, most recent, right? The foreign minister announced that US-China will have some AI dialogues, right? That is hopeful. However, I'm also not very hopeful, you know, in terms of how much, like in terms of room and space, how many topics can US and China can collaborate, cooperate on AI. I'm not so sure. But I think that there are some basic things. If US and China can work together, that will be important and useful, not just for the two countries, but for the entire mankind. For example, AI safety, right? I would argue both US and China are the victims of some safety issues already. If you talk about, you know, scams, you know, deepfake, right? Trump also hate disinformation. And China is also victim of disinformation. If US and China can play the leader role to set some boundaries, you know, at least the two countries can agree on some boundaries, right? And then bring a framework to more international platforms, such as UN or the International Internet Governance Forum, to discuss, that would be more hopeful. The other part is in the military aspect, right? During the last Cold War era, we had the nuclear and non-proliferation agreement, right? Can we have something similar to limit usage of AI, for example, for automated weapons? That is quite scary. I mean, no one can guarantee AI have 100% accuracy. We already saw during the Iran war, there were some attacks, you know, by mistake, right? Hitting the schools on the ground, right? With AI, I don't know whether the chance for AI to go error will be high or low. In the social media era, again, at Meta or Google, we have a very technical term called false positive. Outside the tech industry, no one knows what a false positive means. It basically means an error. But then the false positive sounds like a nice technical term. But can you imagine if AI goes wrong in terms of military attacks? This is not just like a term on the paper. It will cause, you know, casualties of real people's life. So if US and China can sit down, at least set some boundaries, just like during the Cold War, people will be more reasonable about the impact of nuclear, right? And to be honest, I'm not saying that we are going to have a World War II, but AI will be used for wars and conflicts. And the impact will not be smaller than nuclear weapons. It's expensive to maintain nuclear heads. And I believe you look at the Ukrainian war, everybody learned about drone, how drone can be used in the world from the Ukrainian war. And the drone plus AI, that could be also a very dangerous pass.
That's why the two leaders agreed to build a constructive bilateral relations of strategic stability.
Stability, yeah.
So let's hope for they could have worked out some kind of the solutions on that. Turning to the industry side, and you were in the room when Jason Huang mentioned about this data centers are no longer just storage facilities, but also AI factories, and that we have moved from an era where connectivity generates revenue, the social media and internet era, intimately from your time at Meta, an era where compute generates revenue. So as an expert who spent years inside the platform economy, do you agree with him?
Yeah, I as I mentioned, I think we are kind of like moving from the social media era to an AI era, right? If you think about social media era, platform era, share price of Meta, Google going so strong. By the way, for full disclosure, I don't want to sound biased, but I'm still a shareholder of Meta and I'm a shareholder of Nvidia, so I have to make it a public disclosure. But my point is, Remember Mark Zuckerberg went to Congress for the hearing, and then one of the senators asked Mark, like, how do you make money? And then Mark said, Senator, we run ads, right? Mm-hmm. The ads are so useful. People spend a lot of money on Facebook, Instagram, running ads because of the connections, mm-hmm. right? If you think about the platform era, it's mm-hmm. more about the people-to-people connections. Mm-hmm. And then you can sell things and mm-hmm. you can make a more meaningful business interactions, and that will generate opportunities mm-hmm. and opportunities will be translating to revenue. Mm-hmm. This is how companies make money in the platform era. Sure. Okay, now we move on from platform era into the AI era. The monetization model is still in question, right? Mm-hmm. But there are some sort of directions Jensen and other leaders point out. One is sort of the software part. As people talk more about how agentic AI can help people business to boost the efficiency, and you need tokens to grow more agentic AI, right? Mm-hmm. So basically, right now, we still need to tell the AI to do things, and then the AI serve as your agent to finish the job. And the agentic AI will be like, the agents can talk to agents even without too much instruction from the user, from mankind. But you need a lot of tokens to support that. And that there's a term called the tokenomics. Mm. So this is why Jensen, he's very keen to be part of the tokenomics. And back to the basics, right? Fast, the more aggressive the agentic AI developments are, it need more GPUs. Mm, right. So that's good news for companies like Nvidia or AMD, right? Right. On the other part is the physical AI part. Mm-hmm. The physical AI basically means robotics. So you already see in China, we have Unitree, right? Mm-hmm. There's also companies like Boston Dynamics in the US. So robotics is going to generate revenue because people are buying it. Why? If the robotics can help me to do things that save my time, mm-hmm. for example, in housekeeping, cleaning, or some dangerous work, and then the time I don't need to spend on those things, that I can spend those time to do other things, to generate revenue. So this is like a double revenue almost. The robotic can generate revenue, you know, for you because save time for you, right? Yeah. And then you can save the time to do other things, to generate revenue from other opportunities. Mm. So we haven't got a clear business model for both tokenomics and robotics, but I think that the direction is set, you know, pretty clear. And this is why people say we are moving from the platform era to the AI era, as the platform feed still in the center, right? Mm-hmm. You talk about a lot of connection. In the platform era, social media, you don't talk about like your connection with AI, right? Mm-hmm. It's more like your connection with friends. And then friends and friends, you can buy things, sell things, and you can also build a community, right? Mm-hmm. Real people. Mm-hmm. But the AI era, especially now we are entering the agentic AI era, this is more like in your connection with AI and then the agents connected with other agents. But I also want to share some worries about agentic AI. I feel a lot of the problems we see in the platform era. For example, we talked about online safety. Mm-hmm. We know children and women are the two most vulnerable groups, right, in terms of users. Mm-hmm. We know deepfake, a lot of sexual harassment, social media. Those problems were never truly solved in the platform era. And we basically bring those problems, misinformation too, into the AI era. And the worst thing is the cost to cause those problems is getting cheaper and cheaper, almost like a zero, right? In the social media era, if you want to do a deep fake photo or video, you need some expertise, right? And then at least you need to buy some software like Photoshop, right? But nowadays, everybody can produce a deep fake video or photo within a few seconds, almost for free, right? So this is, again, you know, back to the importance of the US-China dialogue on AI. We really need some strong political leadership to guide the world in the right direction. Because I'm very much worried the existing problems in the platform era will just get like double, triple, even worse in the AI era. And then when people wake up, there's casualties, and it would be already too late.
Exactly. Yeah, that's really make AI governance even more important right now.
Exactly. I always say, and I don't want to be biased, I think engineers are important.
Mm-hmm.
But, and we talk about India, right? We can have great engineers, a lot of engineers. But if you think about engineers help to make a product, at the end of the day, you need to sell the product to the government to make a government feel comfortable this is a safe, reliable solution. And you also need to convince the users to use it. Otherwise, the users are concerned about data privacy and other things, the same issues as in the platform era. They're going to use it. So even if it's a perfect product, if there's no user scale, then it means zero.
Exactly. And also about this, another risk is about the unemployment. We also saw the university students in the US are getting
right.
one more anti-AI. So all these kind of problems. My final question is related to one of a very interesting point you made in your latest Substack. Posted anxious in America and anxious in China. You pointed out a stark generational divide. US Gen Z largely sees AI as a threat to jobs and authenticity, while China's Gen Z embraces it as a tool for creativity and opportunity. So why do you think this contrast exists, and how will these different societal attitudes shape this pace and the direction of AI adoption in the two countries?
You know, a lot of my students at Swarthmore are Gen Z, so we talk about this all the time. I feel sorry, you know, for Gen Z from sort of opportunity perspective, right?
Mm-hmm.
It was very unfortunate there was COVID, some of them were in college, you know, they already lost some years. And then after COVID came to AI, and all the world leaders, like not just world leaders, right? You heard the Jamie Dimon, Mark Zuckerberg, everyone's like, I'm going to cut 10%, 20%, 50%. So if you are students in college, you don't feel great about it. Sometimes it's okay to raise questions, raise doubts, but you should also provide some solutions, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's also the US politics part. I like America, I consider myself as a product of US education. When I was in America, sentiment, the political nuances, the society is very different. There's always divided opinions, Democrats or Republicans, but America is never as divided as today.
Yeah.
And if you are the students, you look at what's happening around the country, immigration issues, you know, this and that, you just feel lost. And then not to mention a lot of the American universities are also under attack. I was at the Yale a couple of months ago, and I can tell, and from professors to the students, PhD students, they're all concerned about their funding got cut by the federal government or for other reasons, right? While in China, at least you don't hear people talking about funding cut at Tsinghua, right? The dynamic is very different. You know, at the Tsinghua HKU, it's more like, what can we do? Do you have great ideas? Don't worry about the funding. You can either get a donation or support from the private sector or from the university itself.
Mm-hmm.
So the sentiment is really strange, you know, when you compare the academic world, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then when you look at the job prospect, at least in the tech sectors,
mm-hmm.
when I entered the job market, that was like 20, 30 years ago,
mm-hmm.
it was true. All my fellows, even including myself, if you get a job with a foreign company,
mm.
it means better salaries,
mm.
right? More opportunities.
Sure.
And the gap in terms of income is very large if you work for
yeah.
a bank HSBC versus like a Bank of China, right?
Sure.
Now it's different. All the tech companies in China, ByteDance, Alibaba, Tencent, Baidu, you name it, Huawei, they can very much pay as the same level as the job in the tech companies in the US,
mm.
or maybe even higher. And this is also why they try to recruit a lot of talents from abroad, right? And so the sentiment, at least in the tech sector, I know the sector vary a lot, right? If you talk about real estate, that's a totally different story. But at least in the tech sector, because of the huge capital into the AI developments, the opportunities are still there. I support that. We begin to see China in a way, like places like Shenzhen, Hangzhou, Shanghai, even Beijing, are becoming more like the Silicon Valley. So you know why? Because a lot of the graduates, especially Tsinghua graduates, they don't want to get a job, like their first job. They want to start their own business, right? Startups always have high failure rate, you know, but I'm sure everyone will learn a lot. There's never like a failure. You can always learn a lot in front of failure. And it's always proud to be an entrepreneur. So I think the entrepreneurial spirit is much higher right now in China than in the US among the Gen Z. And plus the policy support and then the different options they can do. And plus, I think the political sentiment also matters. So yeah, I wrote the poster because when I saw the video, Eric Schmidt was booed by the students at Arizona State University. I was quite surprised, right? You know, you can hardly imagine that this will happen in Chinese campus. You know, probably if you get the founder, to give a speech, and the students will have more questions to ask them, how did you do it, right? Rather than just boo the speaker. So yeah, no, that's a very interesting comparison.
If I want to invite you to give one piece of suggestion to the Gen Z who will maybe trying to start their career in this AI age, what is your suggestion to them?
I'm not asking everyone to do startup, but usually you will know whether you have the entrepreneurial part in your heart, because you need to take risks. You know, there are some more conservative people. But for those who want to get into the job market, I would say you need to be patient. It's like learning Chinese Kung Fu. Jin Yong used to say you need to 练内功, right? You need to think about the first 3 or 4 years as the period to grow your inner peace. It's like a qigong. Once you have the energy, and then you can go a long journey, right? The other thing is money matters, but more think about the direction. Whether the direction of whatever you do is something I really want to have a long journey to go for, right? At the Meta, you know, in my time when I was at Meta, we also talk a lot about mission. Right, a mission-driven company, no matter small company or big or small company, mission is very important. Mission is the calling, right? If you truly believe in the mission, like Meta's mission is to keep the world connected and open, right? Now that's a very noble mission. I hope I'm still remembers the mission. And Jensen Huang, you mentioned in his recent speech, he jokingly said, as a CEO, he feels like a religious leader, like SX leader, which I totally get it, right? You know, because you need to see the big picture.
Sure.
Rather than, oh, this is a job, I want to make money, I like to be a salary man. You know, if that's your goal, that's fine. But if you want to make impact, you have to see that whether the direction is the right one for you, and then growing your inner energy, inner peace, and get ready for the opportunities.
Wow, that is really a very good advice for leadership. The patience, inner peace, and the mission.
Right.
So thank you. Thank you very much, Professor Chen.
Thank you.
And that brings us to the end of our discussion today. And today's discussion reminds us that AI competition is far more than models and applications. Behind every AI breakthrough lies a vast infrastructure ecosystem, electricity, data centers, global connectivity networks. As AI becomes increasingly central to economic development and the national power, infrastructure itself is becoming geopolitical. Professor Chen, thank you very much for joining us today. And this is the third episode of Sino AI Insights. And thank you for listening. We'll see you next time.